WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. Sources tell ABC News that a plan to fold the U.S. Agency for International Development into the State Department is well underway, which contradicts Secretary Marco Rubio's letter that called the move a possibility. Point man on government efficiency, Elon Musk essentially shut down the operation, Jeremy Canondike, is past leader at USAID.
An unelected private citizen with cover from the president can go in and just destroy an independent federal agency without any sort of congressional oversight and without any sort of restraints from the law. That is a really, really dangerous playbook.
The Senate confirmed Chris Wright's nomination for energy secretary. The fossil fuel exec has been one of that industry's loudest voices against fighting climate change. After extracting concessions from Canada and Mexico, President Trump paused 25% tariffs on their exports for at least a month. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The Bucks lose to the Grizzlies. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks lost at home, 132-119 to the Memphis Grizzlies. Milwaukee's now lost four of their last five games. The Bucks had the lead, but let it slip away, head coach Doc Rivers.
I thought the game changed in the middle of the third quarter. I think we had a 10-point lead, had the ball on the side out, and turned the ball over, and they got a 3-point play. I thought that was a turning point of the game.
The Bucks are back at it tonight on the road in Oklahoma City against the Thunder. College hoops, Marquette losing at home over the weekend to UConn, 77-69. The Golden Eagles play St. John's tomorrow night. The Badgers beat Northwestern, 75-69. The Wildcats without their second leading scorer, Brooks Barnheiser, after he suffered a broken foot last week. Head coach Chris Collins.
The decision was made to shut it down. He's not going to be with us the rest of the year, but he left it all out there. I'm sorry, I'm getting emotional, but I love that kid.
That's Northwestern head coach Chris Collins. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
There are solutions to the rot in the Supreme Court, and it's a congressional binding code of ethics. There are solutions to the corruption. It's a constitutional amendment to declare that money isn't speech and corporations aren't people, and we can do this. These are things that Americans agree on no matter our party. We all know that presidents aren't kings.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Trump in his trade war, that ought to be fun. Tariffs on Canada, Mexico, China. And which brings me to an email I got from Lester. Lester said that he likes the show, likes when I talk about unions, likes when I talk about working class issues, which we do. He's disappointed, however, with how I deal with the whole China thing. He claims that I'm feeding into the American imperialism, neoliberal politics. That is the trade war going on between the number one imperialist power in the world, the United States, and other countries. He says, check out our history. We created the problem. Now we don't have a problem when other countries compete with us. I think you should do some more research. And nothing drives me crazier then someone said, do your research. And Lester, look, I appreciate you reaching out. Love it. Thank you for sharing your thoughts. But the whole China thing, as you put it, look, it's a mess for certain. One that was created by corporate America's short-term greed and our politicians' short-term ambitions, without questions. Workers got screwed, without question. Look, I marched in the streets against NAFTA and all the other sellout policies of the greed is good era. That said, like it or not, America can't compete with the Chinese Communist Party. Not going to happen. Can't compete with the Chinese Communist Party's ability to exploit cheap labor. Can't do it. Can't compete with their currency manipulation. can't compete with the massive state subsidies, can't compete with the intellectual property theft. And the list goes on. Look, this isn't hard to figure out. China's got massive trade barriers. There is not the same kind of market access. We're not talking about competition on a level playing field. We're talking about a one-sided game where we have been stupid. And this is where I agree with Donald Trump on this issue. Kernel was found. China, the practice of dumping, forced technology transfers. We could go down the list. Falsifying product standards, you know, counterfeit goods, mislabeling, excessive regulations and bureaucracy when it suits them. This is where you go, Lester, maybe do your research and understand that we have been in a trade war for 20 years now. And all of this could have been avoided if American companies and American CEOs weren't addicted to cheap labor and lax environmental rules. That's the reality. And if American consumers, their demand for cheap goods weren't so insatiable. Is our system perfect? No, by no means. But if I have to pick a side on which I'm going to stand, I'm going to stand where my friends and my family are. I'm going to stand in a system that we once had a prosperous working class that created enough jobs to ensure people had the ability to work hard, play by the rules, and get ahead. I'm going to work to fix what's wrong here. And as for the trade talk stuff, we've been in a trade war for a while, and we've been losing. Now, do I think what Trump is doing is going to move us in the right direction? No, I don't think he's a strategic thinker. I don't think he's someone who has any type of plan. I think this is more of that spaghetti theory kind of chaos that we've been seeing thus far. We're going to throw everything out in some bizarre, twisted word policy salad and hope something sticks. Ultimately, I think this is going to be a mistake in holding our allies to a certain level and not the Chinese, but we're going to find out. There's potentially opportunity here. I'm not jumping overboard yet. What I'm saying is I got questions. And for me, the fact that someone would say, and I've gotten a lot of this lately, you just don't understand China. I kind of do, because I've seen the devastation of what our policies have allowed the Chinese to get away with. We allowed it to happen. Look, when they say we lost so many jobs, no, we didn't lose them. We know exactly where they are. We gave them away. We allowed U.S. corporations to move them. There's no question about that, Lester. There's not. I'm 100% with you. But bad policy got us here. We're going to need smart policy to get out of it. And we can reclaim some of those jobs. More importantly, hold on to the future jobs. Hold on to a future economy. But it's going to take us stop being divided. And a part of that is stop with the Chinese talking points. The Chinese have manipulated in every way, shape, or form. And then, oh, well, you know, we're so innocent. No. Now, are we perfect angels? No, I'm not going to say that either. But again, where my feet are on the side of my friends and neighbors, on the jobs that people lost, that I watched lives get worse. So for me, reshoring our manufacturing, something I believe in. For me, domestic production for domestic consumption is an aspirational goal, one that I think a lot of us should be pursuing. But I appreciate the thought, Lester, and I want to hear your thoughts. Do you agree, disagree? Should I do more research on China? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back with Mateus Verningo. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Bloomberg News is reporting that the Trump tariffs against Canada and Mexico will threaten production of automakers across North America and send record vehicle prices even higher, with about $250 billion in trade set to be disrupted. They're saying, you know, the average car price could go up about $3,000 with the cost of a tariff. Now, again, I've had a whole bunch of people say, no, $100,000 car is going to go up 25%. No, that's not quite how this works. There is some leeway there. There's some, you know, who's going to absorb what. So it's not going to all be, it's not that simple of a math. At least I don't think it is. And that's why I've asked my go-to tariff guy, I've asked Mateus Vernengo to come share some thoughts. He's the director of Bucknell's Institute for Public Policy, also an economics professor there at Bucknell. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Rick.
So let's start there. Let's say that the 25% tariffs go into place. Canada makes an awful lot of UAW vehicles. If they want to bring those back into the U.S., $100,000 truck now costs us $125,000. Is that simple of a math?
Well, there are many things in this, but yeah, in principle, all of this stuff, you know, there's a 10% on I think the energy inputs and 25 in, you know, some of the other products, all the other products. And so, in principle, you know, companies just, you know, put past the costs to the extent, you know, the importers will have to pass the cost to the consumers. So, in principle, you have an increase in the price of those goods by 25 or 10% or whatever it is. Of course, the overall price level then doesn't change by the same proportion because, you know, they enter into and factor into the overall price in different ways. As you were saying, it's there are many things that could happen, you know, so it doesn't need to be one-to-one increase in the sense that there are different ways in which they, you know, cars are produced, cars and many other things are produced in complicated, you know, supply chains these days. And you can shift parts of the production from one place to the other. The problems that you have now is that, for example, Mexican cars are produced with lots of parts that are made in the United States. But those parts going into Mexico will now have tariffs because Mexico and Canada will impose tariffs in the U.S. So on the U.S. And so, you know, the exact effects of this are complex. And I don't think that they had studied this. So, you know, the first thing I would say about this, it's somewhat perplexing that they're willy-nilly all of a sudden putting, you know, 25% tariffs on Mexico and Canada and putting only 10%, he had promised 60% on China.
Right.
Which seems, you know, if the problem was China, you know, he kept saying China, 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 you know, all of a sudden, why Mexico, you know? Sure enough, it is true that since the previous set of tariffs in his previous government, the Mexican, you know, trade surplus with the U.S., it was a deficit even at some point, became a large surplus, and that had a counterpart with a large deficit with China. To what extent imposing tariffs on Mexico will actually impact that trade is hard to say. You know, I mean, certainly any sort of changes in the supply chain, where they end up and how people find different ways of, you know, bringing goods into the U.S. in the most, you know, cost-effective way, will take time to happen.
Right.
And so those things don't happen from one day to the other. It's very, very unlikely that, you know, this per se, just with this, would lead to a surge in manufacturing production in the United States. It's not like all of a sudden we're going to start producing those things in the U.S. We know it's hard. You know, there have been an effort to bring cheap production into the United States with significant subsidies and indirect investment by the government. And it's hard to do it very fast because these are, you know, technologies that are difficult to implement. And so I don't foresee in the short run, meaning in the next 2 years before he has to, you know, confront a new election, that it will have a significant dent on manufacturing jobs in the United States or a significant impact on you know, the kinds of relations between Mexico and China to overturn, you know, through these tariffs on Mexico, some possible, going around by Chinese corporations to get into the American market. If that's the logic of this, which, you know, I'm really having a difficult time understanding what's the logic of any of these measures, I should say.
So well, I think it's like a lot of things he does, Mateus. I think he's got a kernel. There's a kernel in there that I agree with, and that is I want to see things made in the U.S. I want to see supply chains being strengthened here, and I think Joe Biden was doing that. I think we had, for the first time in my lifetime, Biden was moving us towards an industrial policy to bring manufacturing back. I think that's the kernel. I don't think they have a clue of what they're doing with this tool to accomplish that goal.
Fair enough. No. I tend to agree that the marketing thing here is we are putting tariffs like McKinley. That's why he keeps bringing McKinley and, you know, the late 19th century as an example. By the way, a period that was terrible for workers, you know, unions, you know, they send the Pinkertons and crack heads. So that was, you know, when he says that was a great period for the United States, the income per capita was very high. If you were Rockefeller, Carnegie, that was a great period. But if you were a worker, not so much, you know. By the way, they also cracked on Chinese immigrants, which, you know, ended up not doing particularly much. I mean, it was negative in, you know, besides being racist and all the other things. But yeah, the point is, it's not a particularly good period for everybody in the United States. So the question he asked is, it was great. Most of the working class was against this back then in the 19th century. They voted against all of this stuff when they tried to vote for Bryan. But that's a, you know, I'm getting lost here. So I agree with you that there is an element of propaganda that we're bringing back jobs. Labor was, for some degree of protection and for made in America. So I think but it's not clear that you can do that without the other important thing that was always part of great expansion of the, American manufacturing sector, which was a large and significant investment of the public sector in good quality jobs. At the same time that the public sector, in particular, when the United States sort of really takes off and becomes the dominant nation in the world, which was not during McKinley, it was after Second World War. It's with massive investments of the state in manufacturing and technology. You know, it's the U.S. government that goes and makes the bomb, makes the computers, makes, you know, at the same time that says to corporations, oh, by the way, you cannot sort of squeeze workers. So that's a period in which we have, wages and the middle class, coming into being. And you cannot say the name of one Robert Barron in the 1950s, you know, because they didn't exist. So, right. So I'm all for, bringing back jobs, but that implies, for example, creating jobs, which is the opposite of what he's doing. He's putting the private sector. So the size of the public sector, in terms of spending, it has not shrunk really since the Reagan years. But because we spent a lot of money giving, it to corporations like Elon Musk's, corporation. But the size of the labor force has shrunk significantly. You know, the federal, employees were about 4% of the labor force. They're 1.5% of the labor force, a little bit more than that these days. So it has, over the last 50 years, shrunk significantly. And they're getting, you know, apparently Elon Musk has access, direct access to the payment system of the Treasury. And they're going to use it to cut what they see as, you know, excesses and things that are not necessary. And those things are exactly the kinds of things that would, you know, it's the spending of the government that, you know, the subsidies that they provide, the kinds of direct spending on the creation of certain things that allow us to generate manufacturing jobs, good jobs in the United States. So they're going to go cutting on those. So also in a way that it's haphazard and not planned by people that have no experience doing this, you know, they just got fired, you know, Friday, the person that was the acting, you know, head of the Treasury, a man that was, you know, nonpartisan, had been at the Treasury apparently for almost 40 years, that actually refused to give this, you know, access to this tool to, correctly so, because nobody voted for Elon Musk and he's not a career, you know, public servant. And so I'm afraid that not only we're not going to generate the jobs, we're going to have higher prices. I don't think inflation, I'm sorry to say, but look at what I'm going to say. I'm sorry to say that we're not going to have inflation. We're going to have higher prices for a while. So inflation will go up in the immediate period, and we're going to have 1-2 years of higher inflation. But it's just one shock. Once those tariffs are in place, what you need to keep inflation going is that workers have to have the strength to go and bargain and, you know, and push again wages, and then you have wage price spirals and you get inflation as we did in the 70s, because in the 70s workers were strong enough to do that. We're not. Workers cannot push back, I'm sorry to say. So we're not going to have inflation, and wages are going to lose to inflation. And he may, with, you know, with Musk and cutting spending and doing crazy things, and the Fed being nervous about this, throw the economy into recession. And who will pay for that recession? It's not Musk. It's not Trump. It's going to make, you know, he already made a fortune out of the election weekend. He got the crypto.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, you know, it's a kleptocracy. We're dealing with the lowest of the low. This is,
and they're not even trying to hide it. Is the interesting point?
No, not at all. Yes,
not, they're very very brazen about this. But you said a moment ago that, you know, we shouldn't rehash, you know, the McKinley era. And I said, look, you know, the 1880s, 1890s are a time I think we should really get intimate with, because this is the era that they want to take us back to. And I think you were spot on in pointing out the fact that those were some of the worst times in American history for people who had to go and work for a living. If you cashed a paycheck, these were not great times. But I've heard a lot of right-wing pundits talking about that as the golden age of America, when we were great. And the kind of greatness.
Oh, these people are absolutely, pardon my French, I don't know if I can say this, they're idiots.
Okay, that's French I'm okay with. No, okay, I mean, they're much worse than that. But
No, I wasn't going more than that. They don't know what they're talking about. I mean, you know, there is a famous book that came out in the late 19th century, which I always tell kids, and you can see the photos on the internet, and you can buy the book still, you know, it's called How the Other Half Lives. This is the period of, you know, of the people living in tenement halls, you know, of terrible conditions for the relatively poor, in a period in which there was no significant welfare to, you know, deal with that. So it ended up being that, you know, poverty was sort of reproduced, criminality increased, you know, these were terrible times. These were not good times.
But I would argue, Mateus, it was a time where you knew which side you were on.
Yes, of course. But, you know, the point is that it was so terrible, so brutal, that even the elites at some point, you know, not McKinley, but, you know, more illustrated people that decided that this was too dangerous to, you know, people like Teddy Roosevelt and then, you know, Wilson, and then, of course, you know, FDR later on, but the progressives. And they said, well, we have to probably curb the excessive power of the trusts, of the oligarchs. And, you know, so it led to a backlash. The backlash, I should say, is with us. I think one of the great mistakes of the Democrats was that, you know, I mean, to a great extent, we owe this, I think, in part, and this thing with China and trade makes all the sense. We owe this, you know, NAFTA, the free trade agreement with Canada and Mexico that he renegotiated in 2018 and called awkwardly UMSCA, that he is now getting rid of, essentially, didn't cause a lot of unemployment. You know, the famous sucking sound of jobs going to Mexico that, you know, back in the 90s was sort of the fear. That didn't happen. But when Clinton, you know, sort of gave China, you know, most favored nation, you know, sort of status, and then allowed, you know, and promoted their entry into the World Trade Organization, and promised us this will have no effect. I'm old enough that I remember this will have no effect on the American working class. That was a lie. He knew it was a lie. That caused the loss of 5 million manufacturing jobs. It led to a destruction of whole parts and whole cities in the country. It caused eventually what led to, you know, the Tea Party and then Trump. But it led also to a resurgence of the left, of people, you know, kids talking about socialism, led to Bernie's insurgency. And Democrats killed that within the party. And I think that that's a terrible mistake, and we are paying for that mistake.
No, I'm with you. So I want to go back to these tariffs for a moment because, again, I think both of us agree that we don't understand what the long game in this is other than just more chaos. How will this, in your view, trickle down to the average working person if this is allowed to go into effect? Now, there are some who are saying this is a bargaining chip. Don't worry about it. It's never going to happen. There are some who have told me, yeah, it's absolutely the long game is we're gonna recreate the world the way I would want it recreated. Do you have any thoughts?
So prices will go up. So this is a shock that it's as large as, if he does it on this, you know, sort of, it's as large as the pandemic shock. So I wouldn't be surprised if inflation sort of accelerates, you know, to something like 8%. It will be localized. It won't be the whole thing, certain things. So we have certain produce that comes from, you know, from Mexico. We have certainly certain things, you know, energy that comes from Canada, he's putting 10% on that, so gas will be more expensive. The repercussions of that are widespread because energy costs go into everything. So they're, you know, they're an input of, you know, we cannot do this without energy. So, you know, it goes into everything. So there'll be a hike in prices. At the same time, he's cracking on, you know, the National Labor's Review Board. he has sort of control, so I don't think we're gonna see a lot of help for workers. That will be obviously inflationary, and wages will be losing. He's also gonna crack down on you know, he's cracking down on immigration, so I think that that's also demoralizing, and in many places will sort of weaken labor, and you know, and so I think that we should expect, and he may very well, by a combination of higher rates of interest that we might get from the Fed, and this meddling with fiscal, you know, issues and the Treasury payments and transfers and so on and so forth, eventually lead to the recession that we had escaped, by the way, that actually the Biden government with the, you know, fiscal packages had allowed us to sort of have a very fast recovery. So this is a return, you know, the growth during his first presidency was lukewarm at best, and, you know, and ended up with, of course, the pandemic and a huge collapse that, you know, we got fast, you know, out because of the fiscal spending. So, you know, yeah. This is just
so what you're telling me, long story short, what you're telling me is no 99-cent eggs, no dollar a gallon gas.
No, I don't think that's coming. No, I actually think that, I mean, eggs, it's something that could happen if, you know, the bird flu that went around, you know, and we were lucky, but, you know, but all the rest seems to indicate if eggs come down, something else will go. I mean, who's going to pick up, you know, if he's cracking on illegal immigration, who's going to pick up, you know, most of the farming products in the United States? So we're going to have issues, not only with the supply chain coming from abroad, but also domestically with many other issues. So I expect, the worst part is not the inflation, it's the wages going down. I expect wages going down, less ability to pay by the working class, harder conditions in the financial market, so harder to buy houses, harder to buy cars because interest rates will remain high. That will impact rents for people that have to rent houses in situations that are already sort of terrible. And when we have a record number of homeless people, you know, in the streets and so on and so forth. So all of this is moving us in the wrong direction to solve the kinds of things that supposedly, you know, he was elected, you know, to resolve, you know, or he suggested to some extent, you know.
Our businessman.
But again, it's the class thing that I think it's important. This is a government of the oligarchs, for the oligarchs, and by the oligarchs. So it's what we're going to get.
Well, aren't you a ray of sunshine? But, you know, that's just the sad reality where we are. Mateus, I appreciate the time. As always, good stuff. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Our good friend Mateus Vernango. Make sure you check out his work at nakedkeynesianism.blogspot.com. Also, he's the director of the Bucknell Institute for Public Policy. Want to hear your thoughts. Anywhere where those eggs are 99 cents, that buck a gallon gas, it's looking further away, isn't it? Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at the RickSmithShow.com. Right back.
News from the Center, WRCE. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A partly cloudy sky for tonight, lows near 5 to 10. For tomorrow, increasing clouds, highs right around 20 degrees. Snow developing for Wednesday. Even some freezing rain mixed at times. High near 30. Current temp is 30.
Matt Nair on air.
Dan Schaefer, Civic Media's political editor.
No court in the country came closer to overturning the 2020 election results than the conservative majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And we have Brad Schimmel, who's been siding with January 6 rioters. So if you want your vote to count going forward, show up and vote on April 1st. Let's channel that energy into the Wisconsin Supreme Court race.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it is rare that it's rare that I take the side of the newspaper of the investor class, the Wall Street Journal, but their editorial board on Friday was not wrong. Not wrong. Dumbest trade war in history. And their opening paragraph, fairly spot on. They write, President Trump will fire his first tariff salvo on Saturday against those notorious American adversaries, Mexico and Canada. They'll get hit with a 25% border tax, while China, a real adversary, will endure 10%. This reminds us of the old Bernard Lewis joke, that it's risky to be America's enemy, but it can be fatal to be its friend. And this is, they're not wrong. Not wrong. And here to share some thoughts on how'd China get off so light? I thought they were the ones that we were targeting all this at. I've asked my good friend Emily De La Bruyere to come talk with us. She is the co-founder of Horizon Advisory. You can check out their work, horizonadvisory.org. Emily, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So we'll start right there. How does China get off so leniently when I thought this was all about China? I thought all of this, China. I thought that was it. I thought that was the target.
I won't profess to know what's actually going on and what the long game is.
Oh, you think there's a long game? That's cute.
Or what the long game isn't. I don't know. I will say, I think that the pessimistic read is that part of what makes China the U.S.'s adversary also makes it really difficult as a recently elected administration to impose the kind of costs on China that we should be imposing. It's one thing to put in 25% tariffs against Mexico and Canada. It's a different thing in terms of the cost that would be imposed on the U.S. consumer to put those tariffs in against China. And if the electoral base voted based on their pocketbooks, and if they might turn against an administration when prices suddenly spike, even if that's what we need as a country, I think the pessimistic view is that that's what's preventing there from being the tariffs that China should get dinged with.
Yeah, and here's my problem, and this is my fear, and we'll start right there, that you're going to cause Canada and Mexico to retaliate. You are going to see inflation spike because of it, and you're going to screw up the use of the tool of tariffs forever. And there's part of me in the that thinks the business community is okay with that. The Elon Musk view of we need a little short-term pain to get our message across. There's part of me that goes, you know what? If he uses this tool poorly, we never use tariffs as a tool again, and that really hurts us.
I mean, I think that you can say that too about so much of what's happening right now. There's a chance, like, the precedent is being thrown out the window. There's real action being taken. That actually, that creates a really tremendous opportunity at a time when we need to change course.
Right.
If we change course in the wrong direction or use tools in the wrong way, then it's not only that we don't take advantage of that opportunity, it's that we never get it again. Yeah. And I mean, there's so much happening too, where you can read it both ways. Like, you can read the tariffs on Canada and Mexico and say, if those are used to put pressure on our allies to elevate their China policy to the level that ours is, that's a good thing. Like, we should be playing hardball with our allies such that they have to play hardball with China. But if they're used, I don't know if spurious is the right word. I don't know if that's what it means. But if they're used in a way that's detached from, like, a real goal, then that's a real problem.
Yeah, but I thought this was about immigrants coming in from the South and just a grievance. I guess we want Canada as the 51st state. That's kind of how I'm reading Trump's play here. Because in this, I guess this is where my problem is. I have no faith in Donald Trump as a strategic entity. I have no use for his strategic thinking, because I don't think it's going to be good for us as a country. Might be great for him. He always seems to find a way to enrich himself, but I think the rest of us get stuck holding the bag.
It is like there's so much that's happened. How many weeks has it been now? 2 weeks?
Forever.
There's so much that's happened, but it's like, we know the tools that are being used. We know the, you know, break glasses that are being broken. We don't know, like, what the next side of the bargaining chip is. Right. And I'm still holding out hope that there is going to be like a, okay, you know, China's a priority, catch up on China. Or at least, like, X is a priority, but you also have to do the China thing. And, well, you know, things are moving fast. Like, we'll find out within the next couple of weeks. And I think that's where, like, we get into the, okay, this doesn't work, or the, okay, actually, like, we could be moving towards something that is proactive.
So do you think benefit of the doubt, this is really about China. You're giving him the benefit of the doubt that there is a plan here that is going to bring China into line, and we're just using Mexico and Canada and the free trade agreement that Donald Trump renegotiated as the leveraging point. Is that what I'm getting from this?
If you gave me the facts of the moment and said, how do you turn this into a best case scenario? That's what I would give you. I don't know what to project and what to anticipate at all. But I think that's how you take what we currently have and turn it into something that works.
Okay. I can wish and hope. And, you know, like they say, wish in one hand, you know, something else with the other. See which one fills up first. And that's where my mind goes. Worst case scenario, if this is just Trump got a thought in his head, and I want tariffs. He learned, you know, from Herbert Hoover. How bad could this be for us globally if we do lose in this arena and China becomes more emboldened and stronger?
I think it's a good framing too. It's like, here's what the best case scenario is of what we currently have. Here's how it goes bad for us. I don't think we should always give our allies whatever they want. And I think we've gone too far in that direction in the past. That said, if we turn absolutely against our allies and don't give them a productive path forward, that risks pushing them toward China. So I think one big risk of how things go bad for us is that instead of saying we're creating a global system ex China, where there are real costs from working with China, we create a global system ex us, where for all of our allies, the costs are greater to be on our side.
Well, that has been our foreign policy for the last, you know, since the end of World War II. Whether it was the Soviet Union or whether it's China or someone else, you know, it's here, we'll give you whatever you want. We'll throw some industry in there. U.S. corporations are going to do really well. The big wigs, the moneyed interest, they're taken care of. But American workers end up holding the bag and getting screwed. You're right. At some point, that dynamic has to change. But here's what I do know. I know the rich and the powerful, the Elon Musks of the world, they don't lose. You know, it's heads I win, tails you lose. So how does this play out in with that frame?
I mean, if we keep letting the business interests that have sold out to China call the shots for the U.S., that's not going to work. I think that's one thing we know for sure. And I mean, that's also why that matches also with why tariffs on China might be lower right now than I would argue they should be. It's not only what's that going to do for prices for the consumer, it's also, or the negative read is, what do tariffs on China do for the moneyed interests that are donating and supporting political interests? And they don't want high tariffs on China because their companies make their products in China. There are a lot of forces. I mean, that's what China does, right? They co-opt the incentives of the rich and powerful in America to make sure they support China's interests. And if that is what where the pressure is coming from, that's really bad for us following through on a China policy we need to have right now.
But because here's my problem. You know, I was reading Trump's response to the Wall Street Journal editorial board comments. And I was reading his response about, you know, how we want, you know, companies to make things here, you know, and doing the same things he always does, you know, the loser editorial board, you know, corporate America, you know, we've been getting ripped off for decades. You know, he's definitely found some things that grab the American people and that we want to believe that he's our champion. But you go through and you read a lot of it's grievance. A lot of it seems to be just, you know, since I'm doing it, it's the best thing ever. And again, I come back to this concern that, one, as Americans, we're not going to tolerate long-term discomfort or sacrifice or pain at all. And that this idea of using tariffs as a tool will be, you know, done going forward, especially because we do need to use them against China. We do need to pull China somewhere into the rest of the world, no?
Absolutely, and we need to impose costs on ourselves. So there has to be the appetite for that. And I think that's also why there has to be a positive messaging to go with the negative, right? Like anything we're doing right now, it's not just because there have been grievances, it's not just because we've been getting ripped off, it's because we're trying to build something. And that message has to go to both the American people and American allies, right? Of like, we're trying to build industry here. We're trying to protect free markets, which fundamentally is like what American foreign policy and domestic policy should be doing. But that has to be connected to any negative measures that are being taken.
So you, as the expert here, and you know, reading the tea leaves that is DC, do you see the cards aligning for this strategy? Did this surprise you? Did this
world
come again?
We're the post expertise world. I don't know anything about what's going on.
Sadly, this is true. And look, you know, as you said at the beginning, this may be the greatest opportunity. He may be the guy who changes the world. You know, generally, when you blow things up and you have to rebuild, there are one of two directions, and you know, we'll see which way this goes, right?
And there has been some messaging that really is spot on. And there are some voices that I think are spot on. Like the rhetoric all campaign on both sides of the aisle was about China. It has been for the past administrations. That recognition isn't going away. The first Trump administration, the Biden administration, both of them were on the same page in terms of diagnosing that we need industry in America. And China has undermined industry in America. Thus far, no one has gotten the answer right. So, like the fundamental, here's the problem we need to solve. I'm like optimistic about that being a problem that continues to try to be solved. I don't want the solution to be the wrong one because this is our third and final chance.
Right. So you think that they've identified the right problem. It's just you know, how we get to solving it, or if we solve it. Is that what I'm hearing?
I think the language, just looking at the past 8 years, yes, has been the right problem from both sides.
And what does that look like? You know, do you think, you know, I mean, you guys game this out. You guys spend time thinking about what reshoring manufacturing looks like, what kind of an economy we're then creating. Because I had someone say, you know, we can't make all the things you want to make here, Rick. We just can't afford it because it would be too costly. We, you know, basically saying we need cheap slave labor from China in order for us to maintain our standard of living. Do you agree with that?
First of all, the realistic thing is we're not going to be able to make everything we need here. But we can protect a free trade system such that it's being made not by slave labor in China. And we can make a hell of a lot more here. And what we get in that scenario is we get an economy where stuff is more expensive, for sure, which also means that we're consuming less, which is probably a good thing. But there's more opportunity for Americans because there are good manufacturing jobs here and there are good manufacturing economies and all of the compounding benefits that those provide. So things get more expensive, we produce less of them, but overall our opportunity space is higher. And at the same time, our move to rebuild industry in America is paired with an effort to take China out of the global economy such that it's not distorting the free trade system, such that we can work with allies to make things, but in a way that's like fair to us and protects our interests as well as those of the global system to meet demand for things we can't make at home.
Do you find it interesting that China's going to the WTO to against us instead of the other way around?
It is wild how much China has weaponized all of the organizations that we've built and that we underwrite in an attempt to protect the system that China distorts. But they're so good at it.
Yeah.
And this is, I mean, this goes back to the fact that we have been, I think we've been too permissive in our role in the international system. And we've let that happen, and we shouldn't let that happen.
I wouldn't say we let it happen. The people who fund our government, the monetary overlords, they got what they wanted. This worked well for corporate America, for the shareholder class. The wealthy got wealthier, wildly beyond their imagination. It's we working people who constantly got stiffed. And now they're concerned that the pitchforks are going to come out. I know some rich people who are concerned. So, you know, this kind of populist rhetoric that we got from Bernie Sanders and from Donald Trump, even though I would have preferred Bernie, has hit a note with people, and we'll see. I guess that's the answer, isn't it? We'll see.
Yeah, exactly. But we'll see soon because things are moving real fast.
You know, I was telling my son, I go, you know, he said, well, what kind of an economy do you think we should be moving toward? I go, well, I look at my grandparents. Yeah, I look at your grandparents. They had two washing machines in their entire life, two of them. That was it. They lasted forever. You know, your mother and I, we've had four. We've been together 28 years. We build disposable things. So you're going to have to build better stuff, better quality stuff. It's going to cost more, and you're going to fix stuff. And just what you said, we're going to consume less. And I think that's a way to start thinking. I don't know that we can. I don't think as a consumer economy that says, hey, we need more, more, more. I want to go to Walmart or Target or wherever and get a whole big box of cheap plastic garbage and that will satisfy me. I don't know that we're a country that can go backward.
I mean, I do think that's a big part of the question. Like, how able are we as a population to accept the costs that we have to accept and make the changes we have to make to get to an economy that works?
So last question I've got for you. Obviously, things are moving fast, as you've said a couple of times. If you're a betting person, and I'm going to guess you're not because you still live in a very nice place. But if you're laying down a bet here, how do you see this playing out in the next several days? Or what are you looking for? Let me put it better. What are you looking for as an indicator that this is going to go the positive direction as opposed to the negative?
I think a big question is what is the bargain that's struck? Like Canada, for example, has said that they're going to retaliate against tariffs, but they've also said that we hope the tariffs aren't imposed for a couple of days so that we can come to an agreement. And I think that agreement, assuming one is struck, and I feel like it's likely that one is, and the concessions that are made and what's asked for is going to be a powerful indication of what priorities are and where things are moving. For instance, if that agreement involves Canada being stricter about not providing a foothold for China or not providing a channel for China to access the US market, and that's a trade that's made to prevent 25% tariffs, I think that's actually a really positive read.
I agree.
And then the flip side is that if there's nothing done on the China question and whatever the bargaining is, that's a really negative read.
And then gas hits $4 a gallon because we get a lot of oil from Canada.
Yes.
And no cheap eggs then. No bucket gallon gas, no 99 cent eggs. What was this election for then?
But imagine if Canada was the 51st state. That would be energy dominance.
That would be energy. There you go. Are we invading anytime soon? Is that your take on this now?
I would be curious if you ask like Western Canada whether they want to be the 51st state in America. I'm curious as to what the numbers would be.
I know my friends in Montreal. No.
Okay, not Montreal, but like Alberta.
All right. Let me know when that poll comes out.
Oh, yeah. I'll be waiting.
Emily, as always, I appreciate your insight, your thoughts, your expertise. Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lots to look forward to. I want to hear your thoughts. Anything you grabbed from Emily's conversation, I want to hear your thoughts on it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That was a day of tragedy for the workers at the Thiokol Chemical Corporation plant in southeastern Georgia. An explosion killed 27 workers and injured dozens more. Explosive material meant for the Vietnam War had instead detonated in Georgia. In the early 1960s, NASA had contracted with the company to build solid rocket motors for the space program. Thiokol acquired 7,400 acres of land at Horse Pen Bluff, an isolated area of land that used to be a plantation. The company built a large 36-building complex. As orders from the space program waned, the company shifted its production to pesticides and munitions. One item they produced was trip flares for use in the Vietnam War. A trip flare is employed by a military operation to secure an area. A flare is connected to a tripwire and ignites if it is triggered. The highly flammable magnesium is a key ingredient to the flares. A fire started in one of the buildings of the plant. The employees were able to evacuate quickly, but they did not leave the area, not realizing the danger of a potential explosion. When the blast came, it could be felt as far as 50 miles away. Some of the victims were hurled 400 feet in the air. An investigation found that explosive materials had been improperly labeled and that the company's fire protection system was woefully inadequate, contributing to the loss of life. After a drawn-out legal battle, victims of the disaster won a federal lawsuit against the company for their negligence. The Vietnam War had taken an unexpected toll on the working people who gave their lives, making trip flares for the battlefront.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Look, I hope Emily's right. Look, I hope there is an optimistic part of this. There are some good people. I as much as I didn't like the North Dakota governor, Doug Burgum, I think on the China issue, he's not horrible. And there are some people who were around Bob Lighthizer in the last Trump administration who are respectable. So there's the potential that there is some good information being given. My problem is I have very little faith in Donald Trump because we saw the first movie. I can't imagine the sequel is going to be any better. Now, do I want him to succeed on this issue? Absolutely. Positively, without question, because this could be it. This could be the last chance that you get to bring China back into the fold, if you will. They have gotten away with breaking the rules for so long. They've gotten away with robbing and pillaging. They've gotten away with their mercantilist policies for so long that it's about time that something be done. Look, Obama talked about it. Trump talked about it. Biden talked about it. Now Trump's talking about it again. Even Bush was talking about it. This idea that we've allowed, and look, this isn't all China. Understand, corporate America did this. The moneyed interests did this. The greed class absolutely did this. That's already on the table. We know how we got here. corporate America wanted cheap exploitable labor. They wanted exploitable environmental regulations. They wanted massive subsidies from the Chinese Communist government. They wanted access to an enormous market. They had dollar signs in their eyes. And they were sold fool's gold. Because what ended up happening is they moved all their production over there. And, oh, by the way, you're not going to be able to actually own this. You've got to partner with a Chinese firm who owns, you know, the majority stake. And, oh, by the way, we're going to rob and pillage. We're going to steal your intellectual property. We're going to retro-engineer it. And then we're going to sell it cheaper. And we're going to break every rule possible to get back into your market. And we're going to use your rules against you. That's the amazing part of all this, and we allowed it to happen. Look, there's no, the politician class, they did this. And this, again, is another one of those instances where big money has destroyed our government, where big money has destroyed our politics, where corporate money, where corporate dollars, where these billionaires who go, I want more. I need a bigger return on my investment. So screw those workers in Iowa or Wisconsin or Minnesota. We're going to Shanghai. Or someplace I can't even pronounce. Because, again, the return on investment is so high. Now, if what Donald Trump is doing is part of not just a five-minute plan, but a longer strategy, then, okay, let's see where this takes us. Again, my problem is I just don't see a strategy. I don't see this administration having that kind of wherewithal to do what needs to be done. And understand, it is a long-term building process. If we're going to reshore the kind of manufacturing that we need to create that prosperous working class again, and from a national security standpoint, be able to produce all of the things that we need, that's going to take a plan. And a very... very detailed one. The kind that, oh, I don't know, maybe China would come up with. Because they have 25-year plans. They've got 100-year plans. It's only here in this country where we think to the next quarter. The next dividend check. To the next midterm election. Instead of thinking down the road, what are we leaving? What are we leaving the next generation? As I've said before, I hope Trump succeeds. I do. Because his failure harms all of us. These tariffs have the potential to be a nightmare. At least I believe that. And I've said that all along. If you misuse a tool, you have the opportunity to cause real harm. And that's possible. And then we never use that tool again. That's my great concern. And as I said at the beginning of Emily's bit, I think the Wall Street Journal is right. The newspaper of the investor class. Sometimes it's hard to be our friend, but sometimes it's fatal. So again, we got what we expected out of China. Out of Canada and out of Mexico. We've got what we expected. And we're going to see if the trade war is fired off. And what's interesting is we didn't have to have a trade war with Canada and Mexico. Our trade war has been with China the entire time. The thing with Canada and Mexico, we did that on purpose. And you can thank Ronald Reagan for that. Thank Reagan and the Reagan administration for dreaming up the North American Free Trade Agreement. Thank you to George H.W. Bush for fully and totally and completely negotiating it. And then thank you, obviously, to Bill Clinton for adding some half measures on environmental and labor rights and then signing it into law so that Democrats could eat the whole you-know-what sandwich and Republicans could get off scot-free. Figure that one out. It's a master trick, but they keep figuring it out. Want to hear your thoughts. What do you think of this potential trade war? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center, and always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. Canada and Mexico made sufficient concessions in Monday's negotiations to stave off 25% tariffs on their exports to the U.S. for at least 30 days. The president doesn't like what they're doing at the borders and complains they treat the U.S. unfairly in trade.
The reality is that economists don't necessarily believe that trade deficits are inherently a bad thing. What a trade deficit means is that you're buying more goods from that country than you're selling to them. But economists say it's actually not a good indicator of how well an economy is doing.
ABC's Selena Wang. In El Salvador, Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced that President Nayib Bukele is offering to accept deportees of any nationality in that country's jails and prisons. He's also offering to accept American prison inmates. Honolulu authorities announced four more arrests in the illegal fireworks explosion New Year's Eve that killed five people and injured 20. 10 people now busted. This is ABC News. NASA and other astronomers are keeping an eye on a space rock discovered just last year.